Hi, you're listening to Radio Nara on 1490 AM or 99.9 FM HD4 or 101.9 FM. This is Health Beyond Borders. I'm your host, Abhi Cherukuri, and today we'll be taking a holistic and inclusive approach to health as we discover and explore other medical practices around the world in hopes of improving our own healthcare or improving your own daily life. With us today, I have Dr. Archana Purushottam, an assistant professor of neurology here at Baylor College of Medicine and the director of the Headache Center at the Michael E. DeBakey Veterans Affairs Medical Center, or MedVAC for short. Thank you so much, Dr. Archanaji, for taking your time out of your day to spend it with us.
Good to be here. I'll be talking to you.
Thank you, thank you. And just for the listeners here, today we'll be discussing Ayurveda and how it can be incorporated into our lives. And I just want to start off here by asking you how you actually got in touch with Ayurveda, how that, became a huge part of your life. How did that start? How early, and how it became a part.
Sure. So I was trained entirely in Western medicine. Ayurveda is something that, it's traditional Indian medicine. It's unclear how old. It's several thousand years old. Exactly how much we don't know. Ayurveda, in some form, sort of permeates a lot of the Indian lifestyle. So without realizing it, there were several principles of Ayurveda that we all followed at home. I came to know, a little more formally about this, maybe about 12, 13 years ago. I shouldn't say I came to know, I got a chance to learn more formally about it. By then, I was a stroke neurologist and I was conducting research, and I came across. I had a chance to work with some Ayurvedic practitioners at a university hospital in Bangalore, and then I got very interested in the matter and have been doing some research into it since then. So that's how I got into it.
Right. Perfect. The research, which we'll go back to further, is really promising. There's already been a few studies here. But for the listeners who haven't, gotten a chance to understand what Ayurveda is, could you give a broad general description of how Ayurveda might differ from our traditional Western medicine? What are those tenets that it has and how that might be incorporated?
Absolutely. So Ayurveda is very, I might say, in one way different in its approach, but in another way similar to any medicine. So it uses the same, history. You take the patient's history, you examine the patient, they have their own methods of examination. Especially the pulse is a big, aid to diagnosis for many practitioners of Ayurveda, but also many other things. They look at several clues, looking just by observation, and they use that to come to a diagnosis. This is pretty much what we do in modern medicine as well. We take a history, we perform an examination. And then using that, and we do perform certain tests in the modern day, and then we come to a diagnosis. So it's a similar process they do also. But their understanding of physiology is very different from modern medicine. So Ayurveda looks at all diseases. In fact, I shouldn't say diseases. Only a small part of Ayurveda, I should, is related to disease. There is another part which is equally important, and that deals with wellness and how to maintain health. Ayurveda literally translates to the science of longevity. Ayu is lifespan, and Veda is knowledge. So it's the knowledge of how to live long and healthy. So a lot of Ayurveda deals with prescriptions for how to be healthy. In fact, the oldest definition of health that is known comes from Ayurveda. And it has a very elaborate description of what is good health, which in modern medicine, medicine concerned itself mostly with disease for a long time in history. And it's much more recent that we talk about health, maintaining health and wellness. So, coming back to that, Ayurveda looks at all life as consisting of three doshas. So the doshas, the challenge is that many of these terms, because it's a completely different idea of the body of physiology, there are no exact translations, but you could think of it as a dosha as physiological processes or functions. So Ayurveda categorizes all our, bodily functions and processes into three. These are called the three doshas. They are kapha, pitta, and vata. So all life requires all three of these kinds of functions and processes. But any derangement of these processes leads to disease. And that is how Ayurveda categorizes everything. There are similarities to Ayurveda and several of the traditional Asian medicinal systems, traditional Chinese medicine, and there's Korean medicine, and there are, other places have other traditional medicines. And they all have a lot of similarity in their basic principles. And there you will find equivalent for terms used in Ayurveda. They will have equivalent terms. So that's very interesting because historically they must have had a lot of crosstalk with each other.
Right, some type of overlap or communication beforehand, right, to build that foundation. And I think it's really, what really interests me about Ayurveda is that it's not just once you have a problem, once you've encountered a problem, it's a solution for your life, preventative before and after. It's a whole lifelong process that's there to actually improve health. And that's a focus that we haven't really had in modern medicine, like you've mentioned, until recently, more about mental health or anything else. So again, very promising on that. In your specific field, how have you seen Ayurveda be possibly introduced? Again, how does Ayurveda look at neurological conditions differently? How is that approach a little different, if you don't mind me asking?
Yeah, so Ayurveda approaches all physiology and disease with the same three dosha framework. So neurology is also approached with the same. Most neurological conditions are considered as disorders of the vata dosha. So I told you of the three doshas, one of them is vata. So neurological conditions come under the vata vyadhi category. And it's interesting, I'll give you some, it's hard to explain, that they're, because modern medicine looks at things in a certain way and categorizes things in a certain way. And Ayurveda categorizes them quite differently because they're looking at it according to these doshas.
Right.
So let me just give you one simple, one example from my field. I'm a stroke neurologist, so
right.
Let's talk about that. The condition is called Pakshaghata, okay, in Ayurveda. Pakshaghata would actually means, a hemiplegia, meaning difficulty in moving one side of your body. So that is what Pakshaghata is. Now, hemiplegia is a common manifestation of stroke, right? But not all strokes need to have hemiplegia. So when in Western medicine, we use the word stroke, we're talking of a specific mechanism of damage to the brain. And that mechanism is simply an interruption of the blood flow. So interruption of blood flow causes that part of the brain to die of lack of oxygen, and that we call a stroke. It doesn't matter what the manifestations are. If that affects the motor system, which controls movement, then you will have paralysis or some abnormal movements. If it affects the speech area, then that would be still called a stroke, but they may not have the deficits in movement. They may just have difficulties with speech. So you understand what I mean, in that manifestations may be different. Now, in Ayurveda, however, Pakshaghata is the diagnosis, and it doesn't matter how that is caused. So, another example would be multiple sclerosis, right? That can also cause hemiplegia, that is weakness of one side of the body. However, when we see a patient with weakness of one side, we are fully focused on trying to figure out what is the cause, and we treat, you know, that determines treatment. So obviously that is what we focus on. But Ayurveda will first classify it as Pakshaghata. Then they will say, was this a sudden occurrence or was this a slow occurrence? Was there fever? You know, various things about what else characterizes that. And then treatment is prescribed for those different things. So the categorization becomes different. Whereas somebody who has just a loss of speech from stroke would not, you know, be called Pakshaghata in the sense of they have not lost that movement. So there are differences, therefore, in these kinds of classifications. So I hope that kind of
No.
makes the
Last
difference
question,
clear.
because again, with Western medicine, we look a lot in terms of the severity of each symptom, and based on that severity of those symptoms, we then decide to classify it in each category. And it really opens up what each condition is, or it makes it a lot messier. But again, with Ayurveda, it's again trying to look at the problem, look directly at the source there, and trying to synthesize that whole history. So no, that's a great explanation. Thank you so much. Moving forward
Let
from
me give you, sorry, let me just tell you one more thing while we are on the topic of Pakshaghata, right? So, although, as I told you, it is considered a disease of the Vata dosha, right? But you can have, and very often, it is not just one dosha which is, you know, deranged. There is often a contribution of the other doshas too. So the way they would look at it is, so sometimes when you have stroke, right, the same hemiplegia, meaning an inability to move one side of the body, along with that, you would in some cases have loss of sensation also, right? So then the sensation, the patient may report a feeling that that side is dead, right? It's heavy, dead. So that will be interpreted as, you know, of course, the primary problem is in the vata, but there is also possibly a kapha problem. Or sometimes patients will report burning, right? Abnormal sensation. That would then be translated as there is an accompanying pitta derangement along with the primary vata. So the symptomatology is used to decode the dosha. I'm of course saying it in a very simple manner. So I'm just it's not just vata, pitta, and kapha. There are many more layers and dimensions to the diagnosis,
If anything,
which
yeah,
yeah,
correct.
which needs years of studying it to be able to do, which I can't. But this is simplistically, this is how, you know, even though it is primarily a vata problem, there are, from the symptoms, they will also infer there are additional derangements along with it.
Gotcha. So yeah, again, those three are not the one and all of how Ayurveda works. But to kind of help listeners along this journey a little, can you try for your best to see to explain the difference between Vata, Kafa and the all those three that you've mentioned now, can you give a little bit of a distinguishing factor to each that when we go through this, they'd, be able to follow along?
Happy to, happy to. So let's start with kapha, right? Kapha is the are all the processes associated with growth, with lubrication, with that would be the main thing. So so for example, and again, these things apply also to different phases of life. Different seasons, different parts of the day, they apply to across various time scales. It's very interesting. And when I'm saying they apply, what I'm saying is, for example, in the early part of life, so when one is very young and in that growing phase, the kapha is very active, right? That principle is active. It predominates. Then when you reach adulthood, during that phase, pitta predominates. Then with age, right, when one becomes a senior citizen, then the vata predominates. So, or it becomes prominent. So that way, same way in a day from when sunrise occurs, the first one third of the day is the kapha tends to be prominent, and the next phase is the pitta phase, and the evening is the vata phase again. Same thing again at night, it's divided into three. So every and this happens with the season. So it's all processes, all of life is governed by these sort of waxing and waning of these different doshic influences. And now coming back, what do they each represent? So kapha, as I was telling you, represents the growth. It also represents lubrication. The second is pitta. Pitta represents, see, they have, I'm giving you some just one or two terms, but they have a lot of implications. So if you're talking of mental processes, kapha has certain correlates. Yeah, if you talk of digestion, it has certain correlates. If you talk of, so everything each of them has, but I'm just giving it very briefly. Pitta, on the other hand, has to do with metabolism, meaning generation of energy and use of that energy. And if we are talking of mental processes, it goes with determination. Getting to the goal directed.
Motivate.
And yeah, kapha tends to be sort of inert, slow to start, but very sustained. And then you look at vata. Vata is movement, especially is vata. Vata also has many other characteristics, dryness. As I said, vata is associated with old age, so you can think of several other things. So yeah, and if it's also movement, so it's also quick thinking, that also grasping things quickly, that also is a vatic feature. So
Oh, so that dynamic process of again movement, or again that intelligent, all of those things would be in Vata, and it resynthesizes what you're saying earlier about whenever you ask a patient, did this happen just now? Was this once an incident or anything else? You're resynthesizing and taking all that information in from just all, again, the day, the season, everything leading up to the moment to create that. So that makes a lot of sense to me. But treatment-wise, again, is Ayurveda something you'd recommend as a preventative measure? Is it something you can use again with those stroke patients you mentioned? And I'm sure I'm at the headache clinic itself, that there's been patients there who could benefit from it. How have you been able to incorporate Ayurveda moving forward in treatment type processes?
right. Yeah, I definitely think Ayurveda can help in many ways. Modern medicine has its successes, but it also has its challenges. You know, modern medicine is extremely good at what we would call acute care, right? Immediate. So that modern medicine is very good at. But when we talk of the more chronic problems, modern medicine is not necessarily as successful. And I have seen a lot of patients helped a lot by Ayurveda. I'm not trying to say Ayurveda cannot help in an acute situation. It can. I've seen patients with a bad headache or a bad migraine. I mean, I'm taking something very simple, right? And I've seen them, you know, apply something and, you know, within a half hour, the headache is gone. So it can work quickly. I'm not saying it's only for chronic, but that's especially one of the things that modern medicine doesn't seem to do as well. When you do have medications for many of these chronic illnesses, they also have a lot of side effects. So these are all challenges. Ayurveda, I do think the preventive aspect is very important and very beneficial. The preventive aspects, modern medicine is rudimentary compared to what Ayurveda prescribes, has so many prescriptions as to how one should live. And with time, we can see how some of them, you know, we agree with that. Yes, this makes modern medicine also has come to the same conclusion that this is what we should do. You know, for instance, you know, sleeping, the sleep wake cycle, maintaining that in rhythm with the sun. You know, these are things which for a long time, modern medicine did not know, but then now the circadian rhythm is something we know very well about, you know. And if sleeping at any time doesn't work, I mean, saying I got 8 hours of sleep, it matters if you got it during the night or if you're trying to sleep from 8 in the morning to 4 in the afternoon, it's never going to be the same as sleeping at night. So this sort of thing. So there are a lot of prescriptions that Ayurveda gives, and that is very, very useful. Of course, the fact is that these have not been researched using modern methodology.
Right.
The fact that it has survived for thousands of years itself tells me that there is value. You know, knowledge does not survive for thousands of years unless there is some utility to it.
It is effective, right? It is effective for a reason that why it's persevered.
That's right. So otherwise these practices die out. If it's just somebody's whim and fancy, they're, you know, thousands of people are not going to keep following it.
Right.
So by experience, you know, these things work, or we are told they work. It's recorded in our Ayurvedic literature. But that is not recorded the way we now want it in our journals, where we want to know how many subjects were enrolled, was it randomized,
the scientific
what was the
process.
Right? These are the buzzwords. This is what modern medicine expects. Mm-hmm. And those kinds of trials have not been done in Ayurveda.
Right.
And now people are starting to do them, but even now we are at, if we want to look at the Western evidence for Ayurveda, there is very little.
Right.
Because not enough resources have been put into it. It has not, you know, it's not considered a priority. It has not been. And so it has not been developed, that field of doing modern methodological research into Ayurveda.
Right.
So one thing is, of course, the you know, the need for to devote a lot more resources into this. But the other factor also is that the methodology of the modern medical studies does not suit Ayurveda.
Right.
Right. I was explaining how the definition of a disease is different in each system. So now, if I want to study stroke, for instance, and should I define it the way I understand stroke, which is interruption in the blood flow to some part of the brain, is that how I should define it? Or should I be defining it as pakshaghata, which doesn't bother really about the
Blood.
how this is happening, but starts with the symptomatology? Because the if you're studying the Ayurvedic treatment, which is prescribed for different kinds of pakshaghata, you should use that kind of diagnosis. And that would not be acceptable by any modern journal.
Right.
That becomes a big challenge.
So that's one challenge for sure in terms of the approach here, in terms of what we define as a success, how we measure that success. One thing that I did want to ask is that another barrier to Ayurveda seems to be, again, how many people are knowledgeable about it moving forward. So what other barriers do you think we can surpass for it to be in the future here, to be start incorporated in healthcare? What do you think we would have to start targeting in order to start increasing Ayurveda?
Yeah, very good point. People are one either unaware or, on the other hand, they're simply skeptical. There is a whole history of colonization, right? That we're the baggage that comes from colonization, where the colonized knowledge systems were always put as far superior to the knowledge system of the colonized. So therefore, Ayurveda for some hundreds of years was treated as and presented as inferior to Western medicine. And the interesting thing is, this is in spite of the fact that when the in the beginning when the Europeans came to India, they have documented extensively the medical system of India and how the local healers would heal and about that system. And they also, there are records where they say they were dependent on these healers to help them survive the new infections and the tropical insects and creatures and infections that they were not their bodies were not used to, and their medicine had no way to deal with that because it hadn't encountered that before, and they depended on the local healers to actually treat them for these problems when they arrive. So coming back, the challenge therefore is to undo these several hundreds of years of stigma associated with Ayurveda, saying it's superstition. It's a very deep knowledge system, and people who without bothering to look at it simply say, "Oh, Ayurveda, all that is superstition." That's they're doing it a great disservice. I mean, you should really look at there is such a huge literature on that. People for over hundreds, thousands, I mean, we don't have all those manuscripts, but because they were not published in paper, and certainly they didn't have computers. So but of even of what we do have, there is so much, people, the original writers, and then the people who came after them writing explanations of explaining the previous textbook, like for generations, where people were adding on to it with their own experience and writing about these things. It's amazing. And we don't realize that it's such a huge knowledge system that exists. But I think now the awareness is improving. And what we need to do, so here's, the same thing happened with yoga, right? It was something that people who were very somewhere were considered, these are very backward, superstitious, or whatever, you know, people who would practice things. And then it has finally, you know, become such the wonders of yoga are still being discovered. I mean, it's such a powerful tool for maintaining health, for you know, including mental health, which is hard to do with no real side effect. So the same way Ayurveda, I think it's inevitable that it's going to really become big. On the but at the same time, one should also be careful because there is a lot of what shall we say, appropriation of traditional knowledge. So a lot of this happens where traditional knowledge systems, the knowledge from those is taken and repackaged with no reference to the original and then presented as somebody else's discovery. And this has happened a lot with Indian knowledge systems. And same thing could happen, and I would say perhaps is happening and has happened with Ayurveda too in small ways, but we should be careful to
Minimize.
develop Ayurveda in a way that, yes, that it, you know, it is still connected to the original source and due credit is given to the original sources.
Right. And that's one thing that I'd love to follow up on, because one thing I've noticed is if you do a quick Google search and you search up Ayurveda, it's very clear in which ones are a repackaged, simplified version of Ayurveda and which ones actually have that material and that deep understanding of the doshas here. Because again, you look at Google or anything else, you can't really trust those sources just because they're the first one to come up. So as we wrap up today, I just want to ask for the listeners again, if they want to learn more about Ayurveda, what would you recommend if you could on where to at least start on or how to even think about it so that in their own life they can start trying to practice Ayurveda or, you know, become more in tune with it?
Yeah, there are a lot of good books on Ayurveda, and there are also in the US there are many Ayurvedic schools or let's say training programs run by different organizations, and many of them offer you know this. For the layperson, they offer Ayurvedic wellness courses. So that's sort of the first course that people take. You know, it may be 6 months or something, and they, you know, for example, every weekend for 6 months, something like that. And that's where they learn about basic Ayurveda and how to live according to Ayurvedic principles. So that is usually the first introductory course. People who then want to go further, then learn further to become an Ayurvedic health counselor, for instance. So there are certification programs for Ayurvedic health counselor. And then there are the Ayurvedic MD programs as well here also. There are a few. But depending on where you live, you know, there are several, I would say, there are several well-known Ayurvedic institutions in India that have branches here. And so when you go to those or you learn from somebody who has trained at one of these reputed, well-established institutions in India, then you know you're getting the genuine, you know, Ayurvedic knowledge.
Thank you, Dr. Archanaji. I just want to ask you one final question for our listeners here. If they'd want to start incorporating Ayurveda into their lives to some degree, I know we've mentioned before that it's difficult to really find a resource online because of that repackaging. But if they want to start getting more involved, get it as part of their daily life and start going down that route, how would you suggest they start making those changes in their lives?
Sure. So with Ayurveda, right, one of the key things is actually diet, which I didn't mention. So diet is really important in Ayurveda. And, you know, it reminds you of the saying that food becomes you. Have you heard that? You know, the food we eat, our bodies are that. So Ayurveda really prescribes a lot of do's and don'ts, and when to eat, how to eat, what to eat, of course, but besides all the other things also, you know, how much water you should drink, when you should drink the water, etc., etc. So food and diet is a very good place to start. Now, how would you know? You know, there are good books on Ayurveda one could read, and depending on where you live, it's very likely that there is some in at least in the bigger cities, most of them where there is a significant Indian population, you will find Ayurvedic
Teachers.
treatment centers, but also those that provide training. They provide sort of you know, short courses on Ayurvedic wellness and how to live life healthily with Ayurveda. So you could start with one of those if you're interested, and use first do the diet, and then there's, you know, other things, sleep, how much exercise you should do. In you know, again, this is contrary to what modern medicine says, but Ayurveda, I don't think modern medicine has looked into it enough, but Ayurveda is very clear. Everybody should not be doing, you know, all out, going all out for exercise. So exercise is recommended, but depending on your own physiology, your prakriti is what they call it. That is the predominance of different doshas varies among people. That's what gives people different natures, right? Some are very fast, some are slow, some are irritable, some are very calm. I mean, so all of this is related to the predominance of different doshas in your body. And so based on that, there is, you know, what you, not everybody, all dosha types are not advised to do the same amount of exercise. So there can be too much of a good thing. So there are many of these things that one could learn and one could easily incorporate into one's life. Now, if it comes actually, if you have a problem that you need Ayurvedic, you want to try Ayurvedic treatment for, then again, I would recommend, you know, making sure you go to somebody who has trained sufficiently. Is, you know, many of the there are many very good Ayurvedic medical colleges in India. So, and we have a lot of graduates from there in the US too. So, learning going to one of them for treatment. Now, a common question that people have is, you know, I'm on Western medicine prescribed medication. Should I? Is it okay to take Ayurveda at the same time? Again, we don't have studies, we don't have research studies that have looked at this that are saying, well, can what happens if we combine them? So use sort of common sense, be cautious, do not suddenly stop all your, you know, Western medicine prescriptions. You know, talk. And usually, even the Ayurvedic practitioner will not advise that you stop everything. So, you know, you would start gradually, and then if the condition gets better, then you might be able to sort of reduce the other Western medicines. Again, under the advice of your Western doctor as well, because if you're getting better, they'll be able to see that and they'll be able to also take that off. So, this is one question a lot of people have, and we don't have any enough data to say what exactly one should do. And besides, that would also differ depending on the problem one has.
Perfect. And then one final thing I'd like to ask to just touch back up. So when you mentioned diet and food, that is one thing that they could focus. How does that, you know, dieting is a part that people are starting to recommend in Western medicine too. So I'd want to ask, how does that differ when it comes to Ayurveda if we want to, you know, start incorporating that into their lives? How would that diet, is there's things that you include herbs wise or anything? How would you recommend?
So there is a saying, and you know, it has to come. This is in Sanskrit. So although I don't know specifically of what Ayurvedic, if it is in a specific Ayurvedic text, but this is sort of a often quoted. So it has to come from the same Ayurvedic knowledge system.
Right, yeah.
And that says, Langhanam Parama Aushadam, that is, fasting is a great medicine. So fasting is, as you might know, is part of normal Indian life, irrespective of you know, which part of India or which group you know, your specific beliefs or ways of worship, all faiths in that come from the subcontinent that originated there, they all practice fasting regularly. And this is supposed to be very important to keep you healthy. Now, again, depending on the prakriti of the person, the it would roughly translate to constitution, the doshic constitution of the person. You know, the extent of fasting also is can may not be this same for all, meaning the recommended amount of fasting. So some prakritis can go for prolonged periods with nothing at all, you know, just complete. This is what people do with intermittent fasting, 16 hours, and they don't eat anything. They do it every day, actually. But there are other prakritis for which that would not be advisable.
Right.
And that may actually be harmful. So Ayurveda is very, there's almost nothing that's prescribed to everyone. Very few things are there which are commonly good for everyone. But everything else, the degree varies as to depending on the individual person. It's a very individualized kind of medicine. That's the important thing about Ayurveda.
Right, that individualized experience. So again, difficult to really say, here's this diet, here's the schedule to follow. But again, if we find those resources, love to share those. And then from there, we can tell the listeners here. But thank you so much for your time and for sharing this with us today, Dr. Arjunaji. Thank you.
You're most welcome, Abhi.
All right.
Namaste to all your listeners and those who are watching too.
Thank you. Thank you. This is Abhi Cherukuri for ending our first episode here of Health Beyond Borders. Thank you guys so much for listening on Radio Nara. And please continue to tune in for our next episode as we keep exploring other forms of medicine and trying to see how we can improve here.